Who is Jesus? It's a question that sparks many answers. But Jesus isn't defined by who we want him to be. He's defined by who he says he is. And in the Bible, Jesus says a lot about who he is. At the Gospel Coalition's 2024 Women's Conference, we'll look at the seven I Am statements in John's Gospel. You'll hear keynote messages from Jen Wilkin, Melissa Kruger, David Platt, and more. Join us June 20th through the 22nd in Indianapolis to feast together on the words of Jesus as we behold the truth and beauty of who he is and then believe in obedience with our whole lives. Register today at tgcw24.org.
It seems as if a lot of the race conversation really started to bubble up to the surface when Trayvon Martin was killed. And then when Mike Brown was murdered in Ferguson, it really became, I think, a bigger deal. But I still don't think it was as divisive or vitriolic as it is now.
Right.
The race conversation has a lot to do with history and identity. You know, so it isn't like we're talking about these super abstract ideas like, you know, you like almond milk, you like soy, and I'm being like petty, but it's like we're dealing to talk about race is to talk about ourselves and the history of our particular people either side. So either I come from a lineage of people who are owned, or I come from a lineage of people that were owners. Hey Saints, welcome to Let's Talk, a podcast from the Gospel Coalition Podcast Network, where we seek to apply biblical wisdom to everyday life. My name is Jackie Hill Perry, and I am here with Jasmine Holmes and Melissa Kruger. We are now halfway through season three. Yay! Insert applause and confetti. We hope you've enjoyed listening into our conversation so far. If there's one that's been particularly helpful to you, we'd love for you to find us on TGC's social media pages and let us know. Today, we're going to be talking about the fun things like race.
Woohoo!
Yay! And how to have godly conversations about it. Jasmine.
That's me. I'm up.
You
okay.
You get to lead.
Let's go. A funny story first. My son, Wynn, who is just the light of my life. When I walk out of my bedroom and I'm like dressed up, he's like, "You look amazing."
That's amazing.
I put on a dress the other day and he went, "You look like a woman."
Aww.
I was like, okay. So I was on a podcast. My husband has a podcast called Make It Plain. I was on his podcast and we were talking about womanhood, black womanhood. And we were talking and I said, you know, my son heard me on the podcast and he heard me say as a black woman. And so we don't talk about like as a black woman, white people, blah, blah, blah. We don't do that in front of Wynn because we really want him to just like develop his own opinions and develop his own, you know. And so that was the first time that I think he'd heard me call myself a black woman. And so he looks at Philip and he goes, "Dada, is mama the black woman?" And Philip was like, "Yeah." And so he comes into the bedroom and he's like, "Mama, are you the black woman?" And I was like, "Yeah, I am the black woman." And he hugs me and he was like, "I knew you were the black woman." And he was like, "I love it so much." So now when he's like, I was asking about his teacher the other day and he was like, "Yeah, you know," so describing her, "she has black hair. She's," and he was like, "Is she the black woman too?" And I was like, "She is the black woman."
Sounds like superheroes.
As well. Like, and he's very into superheroes. And he was like, "Am I the black boy?" And I was like, you are.
I know it. I'm like, does he have a particular connotation with the black woman?
I think he does. He thinks it's like the, like he thinks it comes with that cape, like the black woman. And I'm just like, you keep your all, the black woman, sir. You do that. But he's just very like, the black woman, wow. And so that was the first time that he was like, "Am I the black boy?" And I was like, "Yeah." And he was like, "That is so cool." I was like, "Yeah, I mean, it is. I think it's cool too."
It's great. The in front of it for me.
I was like, it's awesome. It's always the. You're the black woman. Yes, I am. So today we're going to be talking about being the black woman, being all kinds of women and having discussions about race and just getting into all the heavy stuff that's going on right now. But I guess my first conversation before we start digging a hole for ourselves, is what makes this such a minefield of a conversation right now? Because I feel like it's been a difficult conversation always, but is it just me or has it gotten more difficult?
Absolutely.
Recently?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And why is that?
I think there are a couple of reasons. One, I know for someone like me, obviously I'm a white woman.
The white woman.
Yes. Gosh, I feel a little, I don't know what that means.
Hey, if you're the representation of white women,
that is terrifying. I'm sorry. That's terrifying. I've seen so many hurtful things said on social media, mm-hmm. That I can both be fearful to say anything because I'm scared my words might hurt someone unintentionally. Because some of it that I see, that I'm like, that sounds really hurtful. Mm-hmm. I don't think they meant to, but I'm like, when you say it like that, you don't know what you're really saying.
Right.
And then I think there's also, though, I fear my silence is saying something. Sometimes if I don't say anything, do people think I don't care?
Right.
But it's this, you know, I think there's a situation where I know increasingly how much I don't know. And so therefore, it can be hard to have a conversation for me other than where I feel like I want to just ask questions, mm-hmm. and I want to learn more. But what I see happening on social media disturbs me so much because it's so polarizing. Mm-hmm. I want conversations to bring people together, and it seems like people are just shouting at each other. So it makes me sometimes like, that's not a conversation. It feels like people are yelling and I don't even know some of the terms. And so I'm sitting there trying to learn and trying to listen, but it doesn't seem like we're trying to get anywhere in these conversations sometimes. Right. And so that's what I don't know. It just makes it really hard.
Yeah. It seems more about winning than understanding
each
other. Like there's so many canned responses to things, to where you're not just talking about different experiences and different, understandings and learning each other and getting to know each other and confessing ignorance.
Yeah.
Right. Or going to somebody with more knowledge or going to somebody and confessing. You know, it's no longer that relational thing. It's a debate tournament.
Yeah.
At all times so that everything that you say is being put through this lens.
Yeah. A bigger deal, but I still don't think it was as divisive or vitriolic as it is now.
Right.
But I think the Trump era, I don't really know. Yeah. I can't even, we need a sociology professor or something here, or ethics. I don't know. It just seems like the Trump era is when they got like rough.
Yeah.
Especially in the church. Mm-hmm.
Lines got drawn.
Yeah. It became real tribal.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if it's because the race conversation has a lot to do with history and identity,
mm-hmm.
you know? So it isn't like we're talking about these super abstract, ideas, right. Like, you know, you like almond milk, you like soy, and I'm being like petty,
right.
But it's like we're dealing to talk about race is to talk about ourselves and the history of our particular people either side. So either I come from a lineage of people who are owned, or I come from a lineage of people that were owners. Mm-hmm. And so there's
or both. In some
that's
cases.
True.
Yeah.
And so I think that makes it much more of a personal conversation as well as a political or so they say.
It does. And it's we talked about shame in our last episode. And a lot of shame comes up in this conversation and we don't know what to do with it. So it's just kind of like, I think, so when I talk to, perfect example, I grew up in a predominantly white evangelical church. When I talk about my experience growing up there, I have friends who are upset because they're like, well, why didn't you say anything to me? Or how, like, that's not the way that I thought things were, or that's not how I thought things appeared, or that's not how I, you know, and they're not taking into account that, you know, at the time I was 16, 17, 18 mm-hmm. and navigating so much stuff and trying to figure out how I felt and trying to find categories for how I felt and trying to find. And so they feel, I think truly they feel shame And that shame has caused rifts in some of my old relationships where some people I'm still able to be friends with. And, you know, we talk and we love each other and it's great. And some people are just like, you changed. I don't know who you are now because you were conciliatory before and now you're speaking up and we don't know what
and
to do with
that. And that's because you're sharing what your experience was.
Right.
And so that's actually, I mean, to me, it sounds like it's almost saying like, I don't want to know you. Yeah. I don't want to know that part of you.
It's like, I want you to be in this box. You were a safe Black person and now you're not a safe Black person anymore. And your not safeness makes me feel bad. Like, I think there's this reassurance often when I'm talking about race and justice that I get from white brothers and sisters in crisis, that they want me to tell them that they're not, that they're okay, that they're not okay, but I'm not racist. Like I'm not racist. Like I'm not, it's just, I don't know how else to describe it except for it's shame. It is a shame response of please don't make me feel bad about who I am or even who my ancestors were. Cause I didn't know what to do with those feelings.
Wow.
And so I'm going to react very badly because I don't have a healthy way to process what you're saying right
now. That's a great way to describe it. I mean, that's rather than just being able to say, oh, tell me what I missed.
Right.
Yeah, because I felt that with one of our closest families growing up was a Black family in the neighborhood. I mean, we did everything with them. She was my soccer coach. She was the first. I mean, she's like one of the neighborhood moms. You know how neighborhoods have moms. Like every time I make snow cream for my family, I'm like, oh, this is what Miss Scott used to do for us in the neighborhood. But it's only been since I've been older.
What's snow cream?
You haven't had snow cream?
I'm from Texas.
It's like shaved ice.
Well, no, you take the snow. Oh,
legit snow.
Yeah, legit snow. So you take the snow when it snows. This was always like the big neighborhood deal. We went to the Scott's house. And she'd take the snow and you add like sweetened condensed milk. And what else goes in there? Oh, vanilla. And then you just mix it around and it makes this yummy concoction called snow cream.
But that's cheap.
Yeah, yeah. It was yummy.
It was like in a bowl?
She would just put it. Yeah, you put out a clean bowl.
No.
Did you grow up with snow though? No?
Yeah, but we didn't eat it.
Yeah.
No shame.
I'm feeling a little bit ashamed.
We had shaved ice, so that's what
I don't think you should feel shame because I want to eat it.
Yeah. Well, okay, next time.
It was probably clean snow.
Yeah, it was snow. I want it.
Maybe it was, you know, what's that acid rain? We were always a little concerned. But yeah, you set out the bowl the night before so it gets all nice and cold. You know, it only snows a few times in North Carolina, so you got to get really excited.
Oh, they put it in a bowl.
Yes, in a bowl outside.
Because I'm thinking of y'all going in the front yard. Oh, so you don't just go in the front yard and scooping the snow off the grass.
There are animals out there. No,
I was thinking, like, man. Okay. They are some risk takers.
I thought they were like looking to make sure it was clean snow and then like digging it.
The bowl out. I hear you. Snow in the bowl.
Okay. See, I thought you were going and foraging for snow, and I was still going to eat it.
We'll put the recipe for snow cream up.
I'm so sorry, interrupted you. I was just like, I need to know.
But I realized later, growing up, I never thought, what was that experience like for my friend? You know, so I just realized, here's the thing. As a white woman growing up, I was never made to feel small because of what my color of my skin was. Like, I was never called something. You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't actually know what I don't know. And so it was easy to think, well, all that's gone now. You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, nobody does that stuff because I never heard it in my home. I didn't. I mean, and so I want to hear what's the experience of my friends, you know, just to say, oh, I'm sorry that people treated you this way or said this to you, but just because I didn't experience it doesn't mean it's not real what other people experience.
And also just because you're not directly responsible doesn't mean that you can't be empathetic.
Yes.
But I think it's hard to move from, I think people move immediately from, I didn't know this, to you're accusing me of something and I don't like it.
Yes. Rather than just listening to your story.
Right.
Insane. Tell me what that was like.
Right.
Yeah.
And it just it goes so much into so many of the other things that we're talking about this season, because truly it is. It's this shame-filled response. It's a legalistic response. Like, okay, the letter of the law says that you're not being racist unless you use the N-word. That's the letter of the law. So if I had an assumption that was hurtful, I'm not going to apologize for that because that doesn't violate the letter of the law, even though maybe it violates the spirit of the law. You know what I'm saying? And so it's just fraught with so much tension because it's people dealing with what's going on inside of them.
I think what makes it even harder is that, one, these experiences aren't isolated. Mm-hmm. Like your experience is not just Jasmine's experience. Mm-mm. It's a lot of people's mm-hmm. experiences. But you also now have kind of this demonization of sharing your experience as if it's a critical race theorist thing to do.
Right.
Right. And right. So now to even share it is immediately discounted.
Right.
And not heard and not listened to, because now it's like we're being Marxist by
what's
doing
a,
so.
What's a critical race theorist?
You tell us. Because the thing about critical race theory, since we're here now.
Since we're here.
I was like, you know what? People keep talking about this thing. Let me read about it. Because I've been on the critical race theory list. And I said, I ain't never went to no class.
I'm always on that list.
I remember I texted Jasmine. I said, why they keep saying, was there like a meeting that happened at 6 p.m. somewhere in some secret hallway that I was invited to?
I was like, I wasn't there.
I didn't know. I had no idea.
But we both were there, apparently.
We're apparently on the team.
You're behind the whole thing.
I know. We're pulling those
Derek
strings.
Bell and all those people. And so I was like, you know what? I've been in school. I recognize the beauty and the necessity of reading primary sources.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Absolutely.
And so I was like, let me go read what the people who created critical race theory actually say about critical race theory. Mm-hmm. And you know what I realized? One, a lot of people don't know what it is.
Yep.
But two, it's actually really confusing.
It's so confusing.
It's so high level theory that I'm like, for y'all to be saying that everyone is critical race theorists, you're actually making people more brilliant than they actually are.
Huh.
We ain't that smart.
No.
I'm not. To be able to, like, so what is it?
The analogy that
Jasmine
I always...
Jasmine is smart.
Yes, because I feel the same way that Jackie... I have tried to read. I mean, I tried to read. It sounds like I can't read books.
Look, but like, it is like I tried to read.
Confusing.
It's a lot.
Everything also I read, really I'm like... Because I'm sitting there watching on Twitter. Everybody's... It's like... The new bad word to call people.
Yes.
You know,
because it was Marxist. Yes.
Yeah.
It was.
And so I'm SJW. Looking it up and okay. saying, what are they talking about?
I don't know.
So tell us what.
Well, it's interesting because there was a list that came out a while ago, and actually it came from my home state. I think I may be the only Texan who's like, that is where I'm from, and I'm sorry. Because every other Texan is like,
so you're bearing the whole weight of the state.
I'm just like, y'all, I'm sorry. Then they're so proud of it too. And it's like,
but
y'all.
Everybody in Texas who's listening, we love you and we're glad you're
I
here.
Mean, I'm one of you. So
y'all eat things like Luby's.
We do that.
What a burger.
Yeah. And I'm such a Texan that Whataburger gave me food poisoning and I still eat Whataburger. Like that is devotion.
Because
normally if you get food poisoning from food, you're done.
Yeah.
That's true.
I'm still roll up on a Whataburger.
Okay.
Loyalist. But Texas, like some kind of political organization in Texas released this list of words, like watchwords to be looking out for in critical race theory. Identity was on the list. Normative was on the list.
The word normative.
The word identity. The word colonist, colonizer. It was just like a bunch of words. And it was like, this is critical. And I was like, it's such a dilution of what actual critical race theory is that it's kind of like, so I was talking to a teacher and she was like, well, they're teaching critical race theory light at my school. And I was like, what is that? And she was like, well, it's not critical race theory, but it uses some of the same phrases. And I was like, so are they also teaching rocket science light at your school? And she was like, what do you mean? I was like, well, rocket scientists all start out knowing that 2 + 2 = 4. It's very important. It's foundational because it's math. So like anytime you're teaching math, are you training future rocket scientists or are you just teaching a discipline that also is connected to a way more complicated discipline that they're going to run into in the future? And she was like, I never thought about it like that. And I was like, yeah.
I know.
Yeah. It's.
So what is it?
Yeah.
If it's not normative and identity.
If it's not just words.
Right.
It is a legal practice, right? It's a legal, it started out as critical race studies, and a bunch of lawyers were using it in order to have a framework for the injustice that they were seeing, right? And that's about as far as I can go.
Yeah. It seems like it's a lens by which to understand how racism is not just these isolated incidents.
That it's connected.
In the world. Right. But it's also integrated into the structures of our law and our government and all of those types of things.
And the reason why law comes up so much is because the group of people who originally came up with critical race theory were lawyers who were trying to figure out, okay, where's the root of this so that we can figure out how to use our practice to undo this. But that's literally as far as I can tell you.
So why has it become such a curse word then?
I think it's easy because people don't know what it is. So if you don't fully understand it, it's like you guys remember when secular humanism was like all the rage.
I don't actually, but tell me.
Oh my gosh. Do you remember?
I remember that word.
I'm a child of the 90s and I was like a Christian in the 90s. So like secular humanism was like the bad thing.
Yeah.
That was the thing that we were all like really supposed to be looking out for, was secular humanism.
Yeah.
And if you said, what is secular humanism? People would be like, it's secular and it's humanist. And you have to be careful about it because it is both humanist and secular. And so like teenage Jasmine was like, I got to be careful because secular humanists are. Yeah. And then it was like postmodernism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like, what's postmodernism? Yeah. Well, it's just not being traditional. It's like non-traditional. Oh, okay. And then there was a little stint. There was a little season in there where like it was like evolution was going to take down.
Yeah.
The Christian, like, we needed to know how to argue with an evolutionist. It was very important. Yes. It was like, you 7 days of creation, get into it, because they're coming after you. They're coming after you next. So, like, it's always, I just feel like critical race theory is our new villain now, and it's an easy one because it's so hard to understand. Mm-hmm. And there's so many, like, it's one of those things where you understand some phrases from it, and so then you're like, oh, is that critical race theory? Mm-hmm. Do want to be careful because one of the arguments that people have made is like, well, nobody knows what critical race theory is, so why are we talking about it? Mm-hmm. That's not true. People do know what critical race theory is, and they're very devoted to critical race theory, and it is an entire system of thought and practice that truly does exist. So we're not like, this is all a conspiracy. There's no such thing.
Right.
I think what we are saying is that laymen are using terms that they don't fully understand in order to accuse the brethren instead of stopping to try to understand what is actually being said and what is actually being communicated.
It's making us bad listeners.
Right. It's become kind of a dog whistle instead of something that it really does. Like, Marxism is a real thing. But when people were calling me a Marxist 2 years ago, it was like, why? For why? Karl Marx was like super racist, actually. So
because you went to Frankfurt, Germany.
It's because
you visited there. So clearly
you're the Marxist. That Frankfurt school.
Yeah.
And so I think like part of the reason why it's such a divisive topic is because it is so hard to understand for so many laymen. And if you don't understand it and it's just become a collection of buzzwords and phrases, you see those buzzwords and phrases everywhere. You even see them in, I had somebody in my inbox the other day because I love to study history and I like to, what my thing that I like to do is to go back to when Marx was just like 5 years old and hadn't even come up with Marxism, and we were over here in America and people like David Walker and you know, W.E.B. Du Bois later and Uriah Stewart were already talking about race and justice in terminology that people would call critical race theory today, and be like, this completely predates the whole notion of critical race theory. It completely predates Marxism. Like, we've been using this terminology and we've been using this and founding it in biblical principles for a really long time over here in America. And somebody was like, yeah, but W.E.B. Du Bois was a critical race theorist. And I was like, how? That's anachronistic. That doesn't make any sense. And they were like, well, because he says the same things that critical race theorists say. So I guess I'm a Muslim now because I also believe in one God. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just like,
So what you're arguing is it is actually possible to talk about race and racism, how it exists and how it has affected our country without actually being a critical race theorist by doing so.
Yes. And without buying into the complete framework either, because critical race theory, it's not a gospel framework. Right. We're not going to get to Jesus from there.
Right.
It's like evolution.
Right.
You can believe in microevolution, which we actually see happening, mm-hmm. meaning like the moths. I don't know if you remember in school when they talk about the moths and then all the dark ones survived because of all the soot, mm-hmm. you know, that was covering what at London City or whatever.
Yes.
Like we can see certain species do die out because of survival of the fittest within microevolution without then saying I believe in macroevolution.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, so there are parts that we can say, well, hey, we actually see this natural selection happening out in the world today. But, you know, so we can say what is true in this and then what's not, you know, so I can say, no, this macroevolution that we just Big Bang happened and we just came. No, I'm not going to agree with that at all.
Right.
And so I think that's an important kind of way to understand anything.
Yeah.
That even something that, you know, I'm not communist, but I can look at certain things and say, hey, the early church, you know, they sold what they had and they gave to one another.
Well, Melissa, you're being really radical.
I know, sorry. But they weren't communists. Do you know what I'm saying? But they had principles that they were saying, hey, we should share.
They were communal.
Yeah, we should share what we have with each other. But we don't look back at them and say, they were really communist.
Yeah, you know? I mean, like, excellent example.
Start calling each other comrade. I mean,
yeah, we just look back and say, and this is what I think there is common grace in a lot of even bad theories. Yeah, you know, meaning I'm not, you know, whatever, like there's some common grace, like there's something that people are seeing that sometimes, you know, it is good to give what you have and share with others.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make you a communist.
Well, the world is broken. It's groaning for Christ's return.
Yeah.
And Christians aren't the only ones who hear the groaning.
Mm. Yes.
And other people are trying to come up with,
yes,
where is groaning coming from and what can we do about it?
Yes.
And so sometimes they ask really good questions. Like, they're like, hey, do you hear that?
Yeah.
And if you say yes, that doesn't mean that we're on the same page about the solution to, do you hear that?
It's, yeah. Like, many of the founding fathers were deist, but they still applied some Christian principles to things they wrote. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, so people do that.
I have a question for y'all. As teachers, I think one thing we are seeing is that critical race theory is kind of being used as a, I don't want to use the word excuse because that could feel dismissive. But it's being used to limit the kind of history we teach in schools.
Yes.
You know, whether that's Harriet Tubman, whether that's just all the things, right? How do you feel about that as teach? Because I've seen on Twitter in particular where teachers are, and I think I saw it on your page, where teachers are becoming fearful that what can I teach without being like reprimanded?
Right.
When I talk about the Civil War,
right.
When I talk about, you know, the West Atlantic slave trade, will they accuse me of being a critical race theorist by doing so? Like, how do y'all?
I would be lying if I said that didn't have something to do with why I stepped away from teaching. That would be a lie.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, this climate is getting hostile. I'm already the only Black teacher on campus. I already have parents who are complaining about my Instagram. I just like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotta go. I gotta go. Because it's just, it's why really I hard. Yes.
You did. I'm like, you know what? 2 + 2 = 4. And if they start changing and messing with that, we got real problems.
By math, you mean rocket science light.
Yeah, rocket science light. That's nice. What I'm
so what, nice. What should teachers do then? Because there are real teachers that they have to stay.
Yeah. I think we have to teach without fear. I mean, here's the thing. If you just teach history, it will teach. You know, so I think what I'm realizing now when I look back even to American history, there were a lot of things we weren't taught. You know, so just by teaching what truly happened, whether it's with how we, I mean, we were just out in Phoenix and we were in all the Native American land, you know, and we're talking to our kids about the Trail of Tears and what happened. And, you know, and just if we just teach history, with and to me this is a biblical truth. This country was founded by fallible men and women, everybody in it, so we should expect that it's not going to be perfect, because we're waiting for a better country. And the reality is, and please don't hate me for this, the better country's not America, it's heaven.
But if we've connected our entire identity to our country and to nationalism, if we have given in to that idolatry, then if somebody critiques our God, then we're going to be.
Yeah. And I think that's what we have to look at. We should be able to say, yeah, I think I'm thankful I live in America, but it's not home.
Right.
It's not home. I'm a citizen of another country. That's what the Bible tells me. Mm-hmm. My citizenship is in heaven. Mm-hmm. And when I actually live there, then I can say, let's look at the problems. Let's look. Mm-hmm. Let's look at what wasn't perfect. Because right. I'm waiting for a better country. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to prove to you that this is best. But I think we would all say we're so thankful for getting to live here. And, you know, some of the freedoms that we enjoy that other places we're watching around the world don't enjoy. Like, right. I'm not. But still be able to say we have past things that need to be taught mm-hmm. so they're not repeated. I mean, that's the whole history of the Holocaust. We always say what we don't teach, we will repeat. Mm-hmm. And so to me, we have to teach the wrongs that were committed and not be afraid of them, you know, and just be honest mm-hmm. and say, hey, this, yeah, this isn't good. It wasn't yeah. good to buy and sell people.
No.
People are created in the image of God. Yeah, I mean,
right.
if I'm a slave, you know, what does Paul say? He's a bond slave to Jesus. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's who we're the servant of. And so we should be able to look back and say, yeah, there were wrongs. Let's talk about it. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
And some of that is accepting consequences of what happens when you do teach. Because there's certain things they're like, they don't want
yes.
us teaching at all.
Yeah.
They don't want us to talk about it. I think Trail of Tears is one of them. There's like a list of things. And also there's like this litmus test of like, if it makes the white students feel bad, like if it makes them feel bad for being white, which like is very subjective, mm-hmm. Then also don't teach that. I remember when I was in college, one of my professors, I went to his office to talk about the exam, and I saw the autobiography of Malcolm X on his shelf. And he was this white Catholic, you know, Houstonian with Malcolm X on the shelf. And I was like, yo, like, let's talk about this. And he said, I used to have my freshmen read it, but we had to stop reading it because, and it's a small private Christian college. Like, I think it has like, I want to say like less than 5,000 people are on mm-hmm. campus in this college. And we had to stop reading it because it was making the white students feel bad. And we had parents of college students calling the school and being like, it's making them feel bad because Malcolm X calls white people devils, you know, in the beginning of the book, you know, there's a metamorphosis of Malcolm X, you mm-hmm. know, at the beginning of the book, you're like, well, okay. And then at the end of the book, you're like, you know, there's so much, it's one of my favorite books. It's just like you see the growth, right? Mm-hmm. Anyway, I was talking to him and he was like, it just made them feel bad. So I don't really know what to do about that. And I was like, that is so interesting. Cause I don't think anybody ever thought about me when we were reading Huck Finn.
Well,
like nobody was like, poor Jasmine, this must be so awkward. You know what I'm saying? Like mm-hmm. we should take this
kid. Especially if you got to read it out loud in groups.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And nobody, it wasn't even a thought. Mm-hmm. Like it was like, obviously, this is a classic. Yes, there's some things in it that we don't agree with anymore, but we're gonna press through because this is Mark Twain. And he was like, I've never thought about it like that. Like I've never thought about the opposite side of things that make other people uncomfortable, mm-hmm. you know? And
that's why we need to have conversations.
Yes.
I mean, like to me, that's what's desperately needed because how can I know what I don't know? Until right. like that's a classic situation of if you don't have the conversation, then you'll just never get to hear. Oh, yeah. I hadn't thought about that perspective. Wow,
okay.
I think this is again our desire to be God. We think we know everything because we have lived a life. Mm-hmm. And I think the older I get, the more I realize I am one little bitty person in this earth with one experience. Because I even think about this when studying scripture. And, you know, you realize, I don't know anything about first century Jerusalem. I mean, you know, like I'm having to learn what would their perspective be as they...
a different cultural lens.
Yeah, as they read the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, how would an Israelite read the books of Moses? Mm. You know, I'm always trying to put that lens on. And I think that's just, trying to love our neighbor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, trying to listen well. So let me ask this question. Are there particular things in discussion about race that can be really painful? Like if people want to have these conversations, how can we do it well? Or maybe what in the past has not been done well that you've seen that, you know, people can learn from, like, don't say this. I don't know if there's any, you know, like, hey, when you say this, what you need to know is it comes off like this. Does that make sense?
I think before the conversation starts, it's about your disposition, mm-hmm. you know, like, and why am I entering into the conversation? Do I even want to listen or is this a performance? Yeah. Right. Do I want to be challenged? Mm-hmm. Am I strong enough to mm-hmm. hear hard things? Am I able to even discern the things that are being said that has nothing to do with me,
right?
But I'm applying it to me, mm-hmm. you know, kind of this self centered, I think, view mm-hmm. of the conversation. I think it's really how you engage in any conversation,
yeah. right?
Yeah.
With your mother, yeah. with your child, with your husband, with your friend. Mm-hmm. It's let me enter into it with humility, mm-hmm. in the spirit of let me hope the best. Let me put on compassion. Let me walk in kindness and love. Let me be forbearing, meaning let me listen to what the person has to say. Let me be patient in mm-hmm. this situation. Mm-hmm. Like, I think just walking in the spirit as we engage, yeah. honestly, we'll do a whole lot. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure Jasmine has more.
But yeah, I agree with you. And there's so much, there is so much double talk in this conversation where one of the leading criticizers of critical race theory is an atheist that Christians are quoting all the time because he agrees with them. So they quote him. It's okay to quote the atheist on critical race theory, but it's not okay to say anything that sounds like critical. So the double-mindedness is something that I really, really stress that we try to weed out, because our political identity has become so married with our personal identity in this climate to where you can't have a conversation with somebody without being shuffled into a box. Mm. Of, you know, who did you vote for? What do you think about critical race theory? What do you think about the virus? What do you think about, you know what I'm saying? Like, everything is just, everything is so polarized. And so I think, yes, walking by the spirit, and yes, rooting out that tendency that we have to go tribal and to just, we as Christians, especially in this political climate, I think that we've gotten way too far into this, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. Mm. And so it's like, well, yeah, that political commentator is not acting Christ-like, but they're saying what I agree with. So,
rah, rah.
I'm just going to give them a pass. Mm-hmm. Or like, yeah, that critique was not honest. Mm. But I didn't like who they were critiquing. Mm-hmm. So I'm just going to let it go.
Yeah.
Having an allegiance to Christ alone in these conversations is so important. And having a relationship with the people that you're engaging with. I'm on social media, and so at least once a week, a white person asks me a question, and I'm like, that would be a really good question to ask a black person in your community. Mm-hmm. You should care what they think more than you care what I think. And when you approach them, if you've never approached them about anything else, ask yourself why. Mm-hmm. Like, why now? Why when they have utility for you, do you now want to talk about the experiences mm-hmm. of their life? Why now when everything is so polarized and you're wanting a cheat sheet, now that person mm-hmm. is valuable to you? You know, I think walking in genuine relationship with people is really important.
And multiple people.
Yes.
Because I know one thing that can happen is like, well, my black friend said blah, 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 blah.
Because you got one. Yeah, you can always find the one that agrees with you.
You know, I'll say one thing that's been really helpful for me is reading, because sometimes like, you know, it's not your job to help me know everything, you know, like to teach me everything, if that makes sense. Like, we can't expect
some work.
Yeah, we can't mm-hmm. expect that. And so one thing I really recommend, The Warmth of Other Suns, like it was a whole, when we're talking about education, I didn't know about the Great Migration. Hmm. I'd never heard of that. You know, I had actually did learn about the Trail of Tears, mm-hmm. but I never learned about that. You know, and so just it was so helpful. And I love how she weaves together stories, yes. like where different people go. It sat on my desk for like 2 years because it was so thick. And I was so like, this is going to be work.
It's a beautiful book.
Mm-hmm. But it's so well written. So I highly recommend it. But I also recommend fiction if you're not a historian like Jasmine. I found some fiction works that are kind of based on history. I don't know. Have y'all read The Underground Railroad?
I have it in my phone.
Okay. It's good. Yeah. It's good. And I just last week was reading, and this just popped up. It was, what was it called? The Personal Librarian. Hmm. Have you read this?
No, it's on my wish list. It's on my Audible wish list.
Oh, I should have brought it.
I just put it on my Audible wish list.
Like, I just finished it. I have it at home. I should have brought it for you.
That was the look on my face that you saw. I was like,
yeah. But it's about the personal librarian of J.P. Morgan, mm-hmm. kind of at the turn of the century. And she was a black woman who could pass as white. Hmm. And so the reason she could work for him is her mother chose to move to New York and have the whole family pass mm-hmm. as white. And so it helps you. I find fiction can help you walk. You can never experience what another person experiences, but you can at least walk in their shoes a little bit through yeah. a fictional character. And you're like, oh, it just gives you a little more understanding. Yeah. So I don't know. That's been something that's been really helpful for me. I don't know if there are any good books.
I would add though, don't be afraid to also have a diversity of resources, mm-hmm. you know? One time I was having a conversation with a guy at a church and we were talking about sexuality and he was just struggling with just the conservative sexual ethic of potentially not ever having an attraction for a woman and what that meant and mm-hmm. him having to be celibate. And is Romans 1:26-27 actually condemning same-sex mm-hmm. behavior and all the things? And I was like, I would actually challenge you to read both sides, to read those who have a progressive sexual ethic and those who have a conservative sexual ethic and wrestle with it mm-hmm. because you're going to have to wrestle with it at some point. So educate yourself and learn how to gain the wisdom and the discernment and do it in a community. Do it with some wise voices mm-hmm. around you right, that can yeah. point you in the right direction. Right, yeah. But I think just we will lean toward the resources that affirm our biases.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it really is helpful to listen to the people who yeah. you believe you oppose
yeah. Yeah.
so that you're just much more educated in your framework.
That's mm-hmm. a great point.
Yeah. Cast by Isabel Wilkerson is also another one.
I haven't read that one yet.
It's very worth reading. It's weakness, if you want to call it that, is that The Warmth of Other Suns does a better job of, she just tells the story. Mm-hmm. And she leads you right up to the conclusion. And then she's like, and that's the story.
Yeah.
So, and Cast is a lot more pointed. Yeah. And so there's more to disagree with in yeah. Cast. But
I also really enjoyed, or I learned from, let me say it that way, Just Mercy. It was one of the hardest mm-hmm. books to read because what it really confronted me with was even when you read The Warmth of Other Suns, that feels like a long time ago.
Yes.
Just Mercy feels like, oh, that was my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And so reading about our justice system from the perspective of a lawyer, he went down and overturned a bunch of cases
Stevenson, right?
Mm-hmm. Brian Stevenson. Mm-hmm. Did I say the wrong name? Sorry, Brian mm-hmm. Stevenson. Have I seen the movie? I can't remember. The book was, I know, I love the book. Mm-hmm. So I highly recommend the book. It's just a place to start. I also highly recommend Jasmine's new book, Carved in Ebony. As just what I actually loved about it was learning from these women and just knowing they were there. Because we've talked about it, a lot of women in general, mm-hmm. not black women, white women, we're just lost to history. Mm-hmm. And so you did the hard work of finding them. And it's so great to just read, oh, they were there. They were there. Jesus was saving them. Mm. They were doing work. We just don't know about it, mm-hmm. but they were there. Yeah. And you've given women and black women and young girls, you know, of all races, women to follow after. And so highly recommend it.
What's the goal? Hmm. What's the point? You know, because I think people could be so distracted by yeah. all of the like craziness that we've forgotten what the point is,
mm-hmm.
you know? And so why should I read these resources? Why should I try to have a conversation? Why is it wrong to limit the amount of history that we teach about our country, our nation, its systems, its laws. Like, what are we risking by not engaging in this discussion in a godly, healthy way? I don't know how to phrase that prettier, but I guess I just want to reorient us back to, why does this even matter?
It's the supremacy of Christ, because so often the way that we tell history and experience history in this country centers the supremacy of American values and centers the supremacy of our nationalism. And the more that we learn about the ugliness of our past and the way that in spite of that, God still has worked in amazing ways in this country, takes America off the pedestal, takes the cape off of Uncle Sam, and puts Christ at the center where he belongs. Mm-hmm. It's one of the best ways that I found to do that is to just say, you know what? Like, I know that you're proud to be an American, but there are some ugly things that really impact people to this day, still, like right now, like outside of your door, like in your church, because ultimately America is not going, it can't save you. Critical race theory, it cannot save you. Marxism, it cannot save you. It's Jesus. And it's all about pointing to him and the ways in which he is active in a diverse array of lives and stories. I didn't know that. When I was a kid, I thought Jesus was mostly, you know, doing stuff with white people, and I was super lucky because I got to be the exception to the rule. That's really what I thought. One of the best parts about writing Carved in Ebony was just that redemptive, and my first book, Mother to Son, was just that redemptive recentering, not of the Black experience, but of Jesus. And I think we miss that when we center white American exceptionalism as the norm.
And well, and for me, it's just part of, if I love my neighbor as myself, one way I feel loved is when people try to understand my perspective. So to me, I'm trying to do that with my brothers and sisters in Christ all the time, because we're one body. I mean, like we are all part of one body. So I want to understand and love my neighbor as myself. So it's loving God because he created, we know, and we know what the kingdom's going to look like. It's going to be every tongue, tribe, and nation will be praising his name together. But, you know, we all have stories, and I think it's just part of knowing one another and loving one another well.
And I would add, I think it's in Jesus, his high priestly prayer, he prays that may they be one like you and I are one, so that they may believe that you sent me. Is that right? So that our oneness isn't apologetic, really. There are Black religious cults that are being created and are thriving because of the church's response to race. Thriving because what they see is a church that does not look like God, a church that does not look loving, a church that does not love justice, a church that does not care for mercy at the expense of their own comfort. And so I think that's what we're risking, is people actually wanting the gospel. Or our gospel, rather. Even when I was reading earlier this year the autobiography of Malcolm X, I think it was one of the chapters he was just talking about how he viewed Christianity. And why the Muslim faith was so compelling. And I thought to myself, I was like, wow, if white supremacy wasn't so rich in white Christian churches, would he have even been a Muslim? That was the question. I like, would he have wanted Jesus if he actually saw diversity and saw love and saw dignity? Like, I don't think he would have been.
That's what won him over in the end, was going to Mecca and seeing how the Muslim faith united people across ethnicities and cultures was so impactful to him. And he should have been having that experience over here.
And you have people that will say, well, it's because he's totally depraved, he's not elect. It's like, y'all, you have to know that our behavior, our ethics, the way we live, is a part of our gospel presentation, not just our doctrine. Yes. Right?
Watch your life and doctrine.
Exactly.
First.
Why would I believe your God
if
you don't seem to obey the things that you say your God legislates?
Yeah, right.
And so that we're risking a whole lot, namely the gospel.
Yeah. Even if we go into that like intense Calvinistic, well, he just wasn't elect. Okay, but what does the Bible say about teachers who lead people astray? It's better to be thrown into the sea with a millstone tied around your neck.
Mm. Yeah.
Are you leading people astray with how you are living out?
Yeah. And that they're supposed to actually know we're Christians because of how we love one another.
The world sees us.
Yeah.
They are watching.
Yeah, they are watching.
And they are not impressed.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And so I think may we be a church that can have these conversations and love one another well in them.
Mm-hmm. The beautiful thing is, Jesus prayed to the Father, and God is going to answer Jesus' prayer.
Yeah.
And
amen.
So the work that he started in us in the true church, I'm not talking about those who are culturally Christians,
right.
But in the real Christians that are bearing fruit that is in line with the gospel of Jesus Christ, the work that God started in us, he will finish.
Yeah.
Period.
Amen. Amen.
What is your favorite staycation?
I know sometimes I don't like staycations. I'll do them. I just don't prefer them because, again, I'm at home. but I don't know. I think I enjoyed them a lot when I lived in Chicago because me and Preston's first anniversary was a staycation. Mm. And because Chicago has a lot to do. So, like, we just explored the city. We ate at different places. We took a bunch of pictures. Atlanta, it's not that Atlanta's uninteresting. It's just not as cool. A staycation doesn't feel as fun. I just kind of didn't make that cute. I don't like staycations here, honestly. Chicago, yes. Sorry.
We get it, Jackie. You're from the big city.
I'm from St. Louis.
That's bigger. I think it's bigger than Jackson.
I'm sorry. Because y'all don't have a Chipotle.
Chipotle or Trader Joe's or Aldi.
Ooh.
Send Jasmine food.
Please do. Please do.
She needs it.
Melissa, what about your favorite staycation?
Well, I read it wrong. I mean,
or things.
I wish know. I'm not good at staycations because I wish I would just go to fun restaurants and hang out and read books. I ended up that closet. I should clean that closet. I'm terrible. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible. I start all the things that the drawers that bother me. So I need really, if I'm going to have a vacation, I have to go away. Staycation. I'm a terrible staycationer. I just start working. Like, you know, on the things that you can't get to in your normal day.
Right. You're still in your city.
Still in your city.
Yeah. So I just don't feel rested. Mm-hmm. I wish I'd have to actually go to a hotel. If I went to a hotel in my city.
Well, that's what I thought is staycation. Oh,
okay.
That's
maybe I'm doing staycations
wrong. If you're at home, you're just at home. That ain't no staycation.
Okay. I would stay in Uptown Charlotte. That'd probably be fun. I've never done that. Stuff. But I would do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mine is actually in our neighborhood. It's an old house that was converted to a bed and breakfast. It is a 2-minute drive from our house.
They cook for you.
They do. Mm-hmm. And it's really nice. And we love to go there. We go just about every year. And just, you know, have a night away from the kids.
That's nice.
And just chill.
Mm-hmm. Away from the laundry and all that.
Yeah. It's nice. Mm-hmm. It's nice.
That's good.
Yeah. It's a Fairview Inn. It's nice.
That's fun.
Mm-hmm.
Ain't got no Chipotle, though.
Nope.
That's all right.
Nope.
It's going to be guacamole in heaven. I'm believing God.
Amen. It is time to talk about our sponsor for this season of Let's Talk, Crossway Books.
Yay!
We have a lot of books to discuss. Our book to discuss today is Demystifying Decision-Making, A Practical Guide by Amy Joseph. Melissa, tell us all about it because I want my decision-making.
Exactly.
Demystified.
Well, actually, and this book is part of the Crossway TGC partnership. So I got to work with Amy some on this. So I got to hear it from the beginning and talk to her about it and got to see it kind of developed. It's a great book. It's helpful just on how do we make decisions. You know, we talked about this on Let's Talk in either season one or two. Like how do we decide what to do? And I find it's one of the biggest. Yeah, in the 20s and 30s, you're making so many big life decisions. Mm-hmm. But all of life, you're making decisions, you know. And so it's a book that kind of helps you sort through how do I make a decision? What does it look like to make a good decision? How do I listen to the Spirit when I make a decision? How do I find good wisdom from others to make a decision? So it's really helpful on all of those things. So if you're making decisions, even if it's, you know, which yogurt to pick out of the aisle. Yeah, because there's a lot of yogurt choices.
There are a lot of yogurt choices.
So it's on how do we do that?
One of the decisions that we'll have to make is how do we buy this book?
Yeah, ooh, that's good. How do we find it?
Where? Well, if Where? It was 5 years ago, you could probably walk into a bookstore. But the way you Amazon lovers set up, you ruined all of our abilities to walk into bookstores all over the country. But we thank God for Google. And on Google, you can go to crossway.org/plus. And there you can find out how to get 30% off demystifying decision making because of Saints.
Love a deal.
All right, y'all. Thank you for listening to today's episode of Let's Talk. Next week, we are going to have a conversation about how to identify false teaching.